Can I do a Lindsay impression real quick?
Please.
Thank you, thank you. That's the whole impression.
I'm going to kill you.
I'm Alex Higley.
And I'm Lindsay Hunter. And I'm a writer. But... So, Alex, before we get started with our guest today, we have exciting news, do we not?
I think we might have exciting news, yeah.
We have exciting news. Alex is offering his considerable talents in the sphere of editing. And I honestly can't think of anyone more thoughtful and more honest than Alex Higley, if you're looking for someone to give you some edits on something you're working on. But, Alex, thanks, do you want to tell us a little bit about what kinds of projects you're hoping to work on?
Yeah. You know, I had a slight change in how much time I had, with work and the kids. I just have a little bit more, breathing room, and I thought it would be fun to do some manuscript consultations. Cause I had a little bit more time. And yeah. So if anybody would be interested in working with me, I would love to work on novels, collections of stories, either way. Probably just fiction is the only thing I could have any useful thoughts on. But if you're interested, shoot me an email. It's contactalexhigley@gmail.com.
Excellent. Whoever is lucky enough to work with you is in for a treat, I would say.
Thank you, my friend.
Hit him up. And now on to our show. Welcome to I'm a Writer, But. Today we have Alana Massad, who is a queer Israeli-American writer of fiction, nonfiction, and criticism. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, New York Times, LA Times, Washington Post, NPR, Story Quarterly, Tin House's Open Bar, 7x7, Catapult, BuzzFeed, and many more. She is the founder and host of The Other Stories, an interview podcast featuring fiction writers. A graduate of Sarah Lawrence College, she has received her master's in English from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where she is currently a doctoral student. She is the author of the novel All My Mother's Lovers. Welcome, Alana.
Welcome. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
We're so excited to talk to you.
Same here.
What do you have to read?
So I have a very short section from my novel, from All My Mother's Lovers, which is now out in paperback, which is exciting. All right. There you go. And it's from early in the book. The book opens with Maggie's the main character, and her mother Iris dies at the very opening of the book. Mm-hmm. And this is just after Maggie gets home to Oxnard, California, from where she lives in St. Louis, Missouri. And it's just her sort of in her childhood bedroom. Maggie sits in her childhood bedroom for a moment on the single bed her parents never agreed to graduate her out of. She isn't out of breath, but she feels she has to catch it. She isn't dizzy, but she needs everything to stop spinning. She isn't jet-lagged, has never been jet-lagged, but she feels like daylight savings has just happened and that she's flown across the Atlantic to boot. Her room looks nothing like her anymore. It's a reflection of a past self. On the wall above the bed are taped up pictures of an androgynous Johnny Depp torn out of the teen magazines she would buy. Until recently, he was the one exception to her disinterest in men, but when she found out he was an abusive asshole, she had to let him go, not without regret. Beside Johnny are pictures of women, Uma Thurman in Kill Bill, Gwen Stefani in her most punk, no doubt phase, Janet Jackson pre-Justin Timberlake Super Bowl. There's a hole in the center of Gwen's picture from where the poster was ripped out of the magazine, cutting off her cocked hip. "Don't you want to take these down already?" her mother had asked the last time Maggie visited. "It's been long enough, almost a decade." At the time, Maggie had tightened up, had answered something sarcastic or glib or possibly mean. She can't remember, but she knows her mother thought it was silly that this room remain a shrine to her teenage self. Maggie didn't know how to explain that she found comfort in her unchanging room. She liked the teenager she'd been, the raw newness of discovering her desires, the things that made her angry, the causes she became passionate about. She doesn't think high school was her happiest time, and she's pretty suspicious of anyone who thinks it should be, but she knows she was more open then, more willing to extend herself. Everything else shifts, changes, moves, grows up, and dies, she thinks now. So why not keep one thing the same, especially if it isn't hurting anyone? She takes a deep breath and lets herself sink back, her Converse feet still on the floor. Just for a moment, she thinks, and shuts her eyes.
Beautiful.
Thank awesome. You.
Thank you for reading. I was so impressed as I was reading with how you captured the incredibly complex relationship between a mother and a daughter. And, you know, I just wondered how you were able to do that, like what you were thinking as you wrote and how you kept it honest and authentic.
Thank you. I'm glad that that worked for you. it's not going to work for everyone. I think I was trying to think, I was thinking a lot about relationships that are not my own with my mother, because my own mother and I are very close, which is not what Maggie and Iris are. But I have a lot of friends who have very contentious relationships with their mothers. And I've always been fascinated by sort of complicated relationships between mothers and daughters and mothers and sons and just mothers in general. I think that I'm fascinated by the way that we sort of treat motherhood as a position, as a role, as a thing that sort of seems to remove some part of personhood from a mother as opposed to add to it. And so I was thinking a lot about sort of, okay, Iris and Maggie are both people, but Maggie sees her mother as a mother and Iris sees herself as a person. But most children, I think for a long time, if not forever, think of their parents as parents, right? Not as full people, because it's very hard and scary to think of your parents as full people, because then you have to acknowledge how they don't know what the hell they're doing either. So I think I was thinking about sort of how the way they treat each other is going to be different because of the roles that they put on each other, as opposed to seeing each other as people.
Yeah.
Which I think is often how we end up in conflict with other people in general, but especially sort of familial relationships. So I was just trying to think of sort of where are the places that they're missing each other? Where are the places where they're misunderstanding each other? Where are the places that are sort of, where there are rough edges? So where are the little earthquakes between them? And that's, I think, how I sort of managed to construct the relationship between them, really, is thinking about those points of rupture.
Did you start there with an interest in exploring that relationship, those roles between the roles that a mother would play, the roles that a daughter would play within their life with each other? Or was it did you have the characters first and then kind of, you know, work backwards and add that texture? Cause it seems like such a rich place to start even without anything else. It seems like you legitimately could have started at that point.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I didn't, I don't know that I put it into those words yet, or like was aware exactly that that's what I was doing, but that was how it started. So like the first line, what is basically the first line of the book is also this line, the sort of the line that was kicking around my head that made me want to start figuring out who these characters were. And right at the start, I knew that it was about a daughter grieving her mother. And then as I started writing about the daughter, I wanted to know more about the mother. And that's sort of how I figured out that it's not just about Maggie. It's not just about how she feels in a space of grief, but it's also about sort of their whole sort of long time of their relationship that existed before that. And then I realized that I had been writing already about mothers for years. Like lots of my short stories that I used to write, because I seem to be incapable of writing short stories anymore for some reason. For a long time when I was writing short stories, I wrote so many of them as being about like fucked up mothers in one way or another, and sort of wanting to make space for that fucked upness and allow it. And that was sort of one of the things that I figured out early on in the book was that, or in writing this, was that, Maggie's going to discover all sorts of things about Iris that she thinks make her more fucked up in some ways, less fucked up in other ways.
Hmm. Yeah. The letters really allow for that. I mean, if in a really just like base way, it's a way for her to see all the fucked up in this and all the other textures and layers to her mother. I mean, it sounds like you really, the original conception or the conception you were able to have early on in drafting is really what you were able to accomplish.
That, yeah. I mean, I think that early, it was pretty early that I figured out that that was what I wanted to sort of be the central tension in the book.
Did Maggie come first to you or did Iris come first to you?
Maggie came first because of that line, because I just knew that I wanted her to get the news while she was, you know, getting eaten out, basically. Mm-hmm. And I just knew that that was like a really terrible moment to find out.
Yes.
Something like that. But also I think because I'm sort of fascinated by the ways in which sex and death are related. The sort of, you know, the sex drive and the death drive and that Freudian kind of sense. But also just in the way that so often it feels like the way that we talk about sex or the sort of cultural obsession with sex often has to do with a similar cultural obsession with youthfulness and with kind of this anti-death thing, or whether it's actual life-giving or just sort of the vitality of youth that is having sex all of the time. But also how that sort of removes the idea of sex being something that people can have for their entire lives, right? Like we never talk about sex as it pertains to people later in their lives. Not never. We are now starting to, I feel, again, in our culture, sort of do that. Grace and Frankie did that very well. But, you know, it's not common that we talk about that. So just sort of where those things, again, sort of these spaces where things are kind of uncomfortably rubbing up against each other, like sex and death. Mm. And so Maggie came first with that line, but then I sort of figured out pretty quickly that I wanted to bring in Iris as well, because she would be a fascinating perspective to explore as well.
And how long did you work on this book?
Not very long. So, this is the fastest thing I've ever written, probably.
Whoa.
Like the fastest long thing that I've ever written.
I would not have guessed that. I really,
yeah,
really
me either. No, definitely not.
I don't know why. It's mysterious to me. I don't think it'll ever happen again. It's certainly not happening with the project I'm working on now. and I've never written anything this quickly before. I mean, I wrote like a full NaNoWriMo draft once, but it was so terrible. So we're not counting that. But I had written other long things before, you know, like I'd been out on submission to agents with 3 other books before this one. And they all took much longer. Sometimes there were like years breaks in between. One of them, like I rewrote entirely like 4 or 5 different times.
Oh my God.
And with this one, I don't know, like once I got the concept, I started sort of free writing, and then I figured out a plot really early on. Mm. And that really helped, because I had never been a plot driven writer beforehand, and I am not again now. But with this book, I just somehow was like, oh my God, road trip. There's a road trip. I know what's going to happen now. And so then from the beginning of drafting to sending it out to agents was just a little bit over a year, probably, maybe a year and a half with the thinking about it portion before I started writing. It was way faster than anything I'd done before. And like I said, I don't think I will ever be able to do this again. I know there are writers who like literally write a book a year, and I don't know how they do that.
No kidding. Jesus.
It just poured out of you. Were you afraid? Like, I feel like, were you judgy as it was happening? Were you like, oh, no, this isn't supposed to be this easy?
Yes. I kept thinking that this, I mean, I still, to this day, there's a part of me that's sort of like, oh, it can't be that good because it was too easy to write. Mm. Like, it just feels like that's wrong, you know, like it shouldn't have, it can't be good if it's easy, which I know is, you know, I talk about this in therapy. That's just not something we should automatically assume, but you know.
Yeah, I know. I've been wanting to like, I want it to be true that it's okay to have a very fast complete draft. Mm-hmm. Because I work pretty fast, but I torture myself like I torture myself about that, you know, like, oh, no, like I didn't toil enough. But right. But there is like a definite moment where you're like, well, I'm done. This is done. Right. Like, did you have that with this book?
I did. I mean, because I had sort of figured out, I had figured out the plot more or less, you know, like there were all sorts of mysteries along the way. Cause of course, you know, when you're writing that's what happens. But I had the sort of beats down. Mm. Or I had the ideas of like where she would go. I figured out pretty early, like, okay, the men are all going to be in California, except for this one guy who's going to be in Nevada, because that's not too far. I figured out like the driving times, you know, I wanted it to be within this complete sort of smallish unit of time. And I knew what I was writing towards, which also never really happened to me before. But I had mapped in my mind that scene with Peter at the end, between Maggie and her father at the end. I just, I knew that was the goal. Like that conversation was the goal that I had to get to. And so that meant that I really did know when I was getting close, you know, because I was like, oh, okay, here's man number four. We're getting there. Right. And from sort of I remember there being this sort of feeling of rushing towards the end. Like I was going downhill in, you know, the last kind of, I don't know, probably 20,000 words, maybe 15,000 words or so. I was like, oh, I'm almost there. I'm almost there. Like I can taste it, you know? And that was wild and very fun. And I hope that experience happens again. That would be fun.
That's the dream. That is the dream. I've been having these moments in this thing I'm writing right now where I'm like, so she's on a stage on a cruise ship with Paula Abdul. What the fuck? Oh,
there you go.
Wait, like that's where you know you want her to get to?
No, she is literally there.
Oh, she's there in that moment that you're writing. Oh, that's great. Like, I want to know how she got there.
Yeah. Oh, so I'm looking for, I'm, you know, looking for my downhill moment.
Right. But that, I don't know, that sounds like a fun place along the way to be at.
Yeah. We'll see.
With the previous books that you had gone out on submission to agents with, Alana, what was, did it feel completely different than obviously you said the experience of drafting All My Mother's Lovers was much faster than those, but were there other aspects to the drafting that you changed, or was there a difference in approach otherwise that you felt allowed you to really go the distance with this one and ultimately to have the success that it did?
I don't know. I mean, part of me wonders, and I don't know whether this is me. I mean, okay. So I think I'm of two minds about this. I think that two of the books that I had sent out on submission before legitimately still have potential. But they were sort of too weird and too, one was too linguistically weird. The other one was too conceptually weird, to sort of sell, which was what a lot of what I heard from agents, the ones who sort of did ask for the draft, who did ask for the manuscript, who did read it, were sort of like, the writing is nice, but I don't have any idea what to do with this, you know? With the other one, with the third one that I had sent out, I think that it just wasn't put together right. That's the one that I sort of rewrote many times. And I think that just when I pull things apart that way and try to put them back together, I'm not sure that works for me as a writer. Right. I know that a lot of people are super capable of doing that. I'm not sure that I am. But with this one, part of what made me sort of feel like, oh, this is the one that it's going to happen with, was because the concept was so commercial. And I don't mean that in a bad way or in a judgmental way. I just mean that as like, it just was, you know, like it was something where I had a clear, like, here's my clear log line. Here's my, like, it's this meets this for my pitch.
Right.
And I had worked for an agent for years. And so I also sort of knew what the way that people wanted queries to look by then. I knew the way my boss wanted queries to look. I knew the way I, as the assistant person, like, needed queries to look. I knew how my friends who were assistants or like people that I knew who were agents seemed to want queries to look. And so I also just knew how to tailor the shit out of that query letter, you know, just because I'd had so much practice reading other people's.
Were you doing that work while you were drafting All My Mother's Lovers, or was that work that came a little bit earlier when you were working on the previous novels? What kind of overlap did your, or are you still doing that work? I'm not even sure.
No, I'm not. Okay. I mean, I still occasionally freelance for that agent doing some editing work for her, but I was probably, let's see. So I drafted this book during my first year of my PhD program, and I was working with her sort of through the first half of that year, but I don't think I really started working on the book until the second semester. So probably just missed each other sort of. But yeah, I had been working on some of the other books while I was working for her. And like, I knew that they weren't, you know, I knew that it wasn't the commercial thing that people wanted, but you know, I mean, I was like 25 and I thought, well, maybe I'll just fall for the right one. Or maybe there was some part of me that was like, well, it's clearly brilliant, and so someone will pick up on it. but it didn't. No one did, and that's okay.
say more about that.
I think that there's this weird thing that I suspect both of you, and I think a lot of writers would relate to, is that on the one hand, you have like this truly painful, torturous self-doubt, yes, this belief that like you can't be a good writer. Everyone who's told you you're a good writer has been lying to you to make you feel like you know, just either so they wouldn't have to tell you the truth, or so that they could just spare your feelings, or so they didn't have to deal with you having a meltdown about them telling you the truth. You know, like you invent all sorts of reasons in your head for why you're actually a terrible writer, or you're not writing enough, or you're not writing the right way. But then there's a small part of you that like has to believe that you are the best fucking thing ever, or else, you know, you would never write again. I mean, it maybe not the best ever, but like there's a part of you that believes like that it's worth it, and that you are worth it, and that the writing that you're creating, maybe not you, at least I feel very divorced from my writing a lot of the time. But you know, there's that part that knows that this is worthwhile, and that you are talented, and that you need to do this, and that other people will actually enjoy reading this. Because if you didn't have that at all, you wouldn't keep going through the sort of morass of what it means to try to be a writer in 21st century, you know, late capitalism, neoliberal, et cetera, you know, in the sort of this tragic world we live in. Like, why do any of us do this, right? Like, there's some part that feels like it's worth it. And so I think, you know, with some of those earlier things that I wrote that were sort of experimental, or I was like trying to go for something really strange that I really believed in, there was a part of me that still believes in those things. And I had to believe them at the time, but there's a part of me that also looks back and is like, aw, you were so naive, and you thought that like people gave a shit about your weird little experiments.
I know. I swear I have some books that I look back and I'm like, oh, that was just like your little construction paper and your Elmer's glue.
Right. Like, exactly. But like, you were really excited about, yes, them. And like you constructed an entire, you know, critical theory around your construction paper and your Elmer's glue, because, yeah, you just explained how it was brilliant to yourself, you know.
It was meaningful to me. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Exactly.
Can you talk about what it was like sort of from selling the book to basically right now to put a book out? Because I know I ask that a lot of people, but I think that's something that a lot of unpublished authors are really curious about. And I think there's a lot of misconceptions about it, and everyone's experience is different. So I would just love to hear your experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that it's a strange one. I mean, not unique to me, strange to our time, because I had like, you know, a pandemic book, right? Which is just a slightly different reality than I think some authors go through. The process was also sort of very freakishly fast in my case. And I know it was freakishly fast because, as I said, I had worked for an agent, and I knew how slow the process of publication usually is, you know. But between sort of from finding an agent, which also happened freakishly fast, to selling it was like 2.5 months. I know. It was very strange. But also, he sent it out, I think, to 17 editors, right? Like, you know, they send out a big first batch a lot of the time. And within a week, we had gotten 15 rejections.
Oh my gosh.
So it was also like everyone read it really fast and decided really quickly that it was not for them. Wow. So all of this was like, I don't know why, I don't know how. Part of me is like, oh, well, maybe it was because you worked so hard for like 8 years before this happened, or nearly a decade before you actually sold it. And so like the universe was just speeding things up for you. And then I know that that's not true, because many people, you know, toil for 10, 15, 20 years before they have a book come out. So no, unfortunately not. It was just weird, strange luck. And then because they wanted it to come out near Pride Month and near Mother's Day, because of the title and because it's about a queer woman, it was, I think, bought in like March, maybe April, and then it came out like a year and a month later, which is also freakishly fast. Yeah, but my editor and I were like, well, let's try. And then we just sort of worked really quickly, and I made sure to meet my deadlines very heartily, obsessively, perhaps.
Jeez.
It was very weird. And that is abnormal. Like, to any listeners out there, it usually takes between a year and a half to 3 years, you know, from the moment that you sell the book.
Yeah. And then it's like, you get asked questions about it and you're like, what? That was like two books ago. Like, yes. I have no idea what I was doing, what I meant.
Exactly.
Well, how, like, psychologically, this past year, like having your book out and having to endure people reading it and reacting to it, you know, like what was that like?
I don't know who said this, but someone said to me, and I think might have said it more broadly than to me, I might have heard it on something, maybe it was a teacher, I wish I knew who said it, but someone said that publishing is the exact opposite of writing. And I find that to be very true, because you're doing anything but writing, right? When you're doing the publication process, even though you might actually be writing a lot, like you might be writing responses to interviewers, or you might be working on jacket copy, or, you know, doing the silly author questionnaire thing that you have to do, or writing emails.
The worst.
Yes. So strange. and just sort of bizarre. Cause again, yeah, it's interrogating you about sort of the things that you thought and believed, and tries to get you to like market your work somehow, or to make bits of yourself marketable, which is like not the point of writing fiction.
Yes. Oh, this is like therapy for me.
Right. It's very weird. So I mean, I think it was weird for all sorts of reasons. It was weird because I was already, like when the pandemic started, not when it started, but when it was declared a pandemic in, I think, March of 2020, I had like a party planned fully, but, you know, I was supposed to be having my launch at the Strand in New York, and I was so excited.
Gosh.
Right. I mean, I was so excited, and like, you know, I have a lot of friends in New York, so I was really excited to get to celebrate with a lot of my friends. My mom was going to fly out, and I had a lot of friends who were going, oh, but you know, that's in May. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, no, like I mourned way before it was officially canceled, because I am a pessimist. And so I saw the way the wind was blowing, and I was like, there's no way this is going to be over by May. Like that's not how this kind of stuff works. So I think I was really sad about it for a while, but then my friends in Nebraska managed to make my actual launch day really fun. And like, I did a virtual event with the Strand, and I did a virtual event with McNally Jackson. And so those made me feel like, oh, you know, this is really real, in those moments of being in those Zoom rooms doing that. Right. But I think sort of, at least for me, and maybe for other people too, the minute I'm not like actively sort of talking to other people about the fact that, oh yes, this is my book and I wrote a book, it's like, oh, what? I have a book?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah.
And like, it's not something that's at the top of your mind all the time. You're thinking about everything else in your life, and also about how you should be writing, or you want to be writing, or you're thinking about the next book. Like, you're not thinking, oh, I'm a published author. Like, you're not walking around thinking that all day long, you know?
You're not, and mostly just, I am.
I mean, maybe some days, you know, I'm not. Okay.
No, fair. No, I'm not. I'm not.
So, you know, it mostly just feels like the same as everything felt before I was a published author.
Yeah, I think
makes sense.
It does. And I think that's something that is hard to accept, you know, mm-hmm. like it does feel like a groundbreaking achievement. And it is, you know, like it is a miracle to get a book published, and that is becoming yeah. more and more true. Mm-hmm. And yet you still have to wake up and do the work and feed yourself and mm-hmm. think your thoughts and live your life and deal with your family. And, you know, like, and it's, mm-hmm. it feels like it should change something, but it doesn't really.
It
and
really
I think
doesn't.
Down the line, it's something you can feel really proud of and, you know, like, and you can hold it and just think of the work that went into it because it's, you've got some distance from it, but in the, you know, in that immediate time afterward, I know for me and maybe for you, like it does feel like, wait a minute, like shouldn't people be stopping me on the street to be like,
right,
hey, you had a book, you know?
Well, I think it's partially because as readers, or I mean, yeah. maybe this is just for me, but like as a reader, I think of my favorite authors as, you know, like these gods, these heroes, these totally. Like incredible people who are able to make worlds appear in my head, or able to like make me feel things, or able to transport me into lives I will never live, right? It seems like this miraculous, amazing thing. But when you're the person doing it, it might feel miraculous and amazing sometimes within the process, sometimes thinking back on it, but like, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. most of the time you're not going to be like, you're not surrounded by your best readers all day long
who right.
can remind you how amazing it is that you can do this thing.
Right. Exactly. Like, you know, like my kids are still going to be like, Mom, get me milk.
Right.
And I can't be like, excuse me. Didn't you see what, you know, this blurb said on the back of it, you know?
Exactly. Right.
Try that tomorrow, Lindsay. See how it goes over. Just,
you know,
try
I will try. No, my oldest is like, Mo Willems has awards on his book. Like, why don't you have, like, did you not win any awards?
Shade.
Mom, are you a bestseller? And I have to be like, no, but it's still a perfectly fine career. You know?
Oh my goodness. Yes. Like, if your kids are also just speaking the little voice in your head that's saying, but you didn't win any awards.
Exactly. Exactly. God. I know. Oh my God. I remember my first novel was Ugly Girls. And it's like, it's, I love it. But I remember expecting like something like that. And I look back now and I'm like, what the hell was I thinking? Like, what was I thinking? I was just in this like cloud world, you know, like you learn as you go.
Yeah. And I think, again, it's like that hubris that we have to have in order to survive publishing a book
yes.
once and then trying to do it again.
And that
trying to get to there.
Also.
Yeah, and the innocence, absolutely. I think those together can be deadly sometimes.
Yes.
To our egos.
Well, you said you're writing something now and you're doing some research as well.
Yes.
What are you doing?
Yeah, I'm trying to write another book. It's also will be my dissertation for my PhD, hopefully. So like I have two reasons to sort of try to actually finish it and keep going. Yeah, and I'm doing a lot of research about the 50s and 60s. I'm making the mistake of writing somewhat about the pandemic, which I don't know. I'm hopeful that sort of if it does get sold, then by the time it comes out, it won't feel too soon mm-hmm. anymore by then. Mm-hmm. But who knows? It might just feel like, oh, still, like this is just a reflection of our new reality. Who knows? It's weirder than my first book. I'm going back to some of my weirder impulses in terms of like point of view and voice and stuff. And we'll see what happens. I'm still sort of in the muddling through and trying to figure out if it's worth it. I mean, it is worth it. It has to be worth it because I'm already like 40,000 words in. So I can't turn back now.
No, you can't.
But I'm in the middle and I hate the middle.
Mm-hmm.
I hate writing the middle.
Yeah.
the hardest.
Do you enjoy the research? Is the research fun for you, or is it something that you're like, I just want to get back to sentences?
It depends on the day. Like some days the research is really fun, and some days it's so overwhelming and I feel like I have to research too much and like I'll never get back to the writing. So it's a sort of balancing act, because I can also disappear in the research, which is why I sort of very deliberately, after about 6 months of just sort of telling myself I was doing research, I was like, okay, you have to stop and actually start writing, because if you keep just reading books occasionally and like watching movies and telling yourself you're doing research, you will never write. So yeah.
It can be painful to get back in.
Yes. It's hard. It's weird.
Was it something that you were working on while you were also like doing events for All My Mother's Lovers?
Not quite, but okay. Almost. Like I started developing the idea around like pretty soon after the book came out. And I started having, you know how like, well, I don't know if everyone works this way. Obviously all writers work very differently. But for me at least, I seem to sort of have something where there's an idea that just stays around my head and kind of, I can't write it yet. I can't even talk about it yet. I just get really interested in it. And I think about it and I think about things that are adjacent to it. So for this, it was sort of like the alien abduction phenomenon. I just was thinking about it a whole lot and like listening to other podcasts about it. And then thinking about, why were people abducted? Was it the Cold War? Is that like why people kept having abduction experiences? Were people seeing UFOs because they were like imagining the danger from afar? In this country anyway, right?
Right.
And I just sort of circled this topic for a while and sort of slowly allowed myself to genuinely become interested in UFO things without making fun of myself and apologizing for it all the time.
No, they're real. Okay. They are real.
I mean, the government has confirmed that, which now, of course, which should make us all very, very suspicious, because the government does not. I mean, on the one hand, governments tend to be very, very inept, and we probably ascribe a lot more meaning to them than they actually have, right? But I do think that it's suspicious somewhat that they just said that they don't know at all without sort of any theories. But they're real. There's something out there.
I thought they were just saying that so that they could throw a whole bunch more money at NASA and we'd all be like, okay.
But the thing is, like, didn't we all want NASA to do stuff anyway? Like, I would vastly prefer NASA to do things than freaking Jeff Bezos going to space.
That's true. That's true. Have you seen that movie, The Vast of Night?
No.
Okay, it's set in the title. It is such a good movie. It's set in the 50s, so around the time that you're researching. And it's about alien. I won't say much more, but it's great. It is.
Oh, The Vast of Night. Okay, I'm putting that on my list now. I'm going to send a text to my partner so that we can put that on our like movie list.
It is so, so good.
Thank you for the recommendation.
Sure. You mentioned that you're getting weird with this project. Was that like a conscious decision, or was it what this project required?
I never know, because part of me always wonders, like, am I playing with weird stuff because it makes me feel like the book is smarter or something?
Oh.
And
that's such an honest answer.
Yeah.
Well, I love that answer.
I think it's because I sort of, I don't know. I mean, I started discovering experimental fiction when I was in college, and like I studied with David Hollander at Sarah Lawrence. I had one class with him, and he encouraged a lot of play in our writing, and he encouraged a lot of like, just try things out, do weird stuff, use like conceits and use boundaries that you know, like have to write within in order to make something feel weird, right? Like one of my favorite exercises that I still give to my own students when I teach is write a 200 word story that only uses 50 different words. Amazing. Like one of my favorite stories that I've ever written that ended up being much longer than that, but it started from just that idea and like that repetition and what that makes you sort of focus on, right? But I started really getting into experimental fiction in college, and I think part of I think at the time, part of it was like, oh, this is really smart. This is really like sophisticated, you know? And so I'm constantly sort of questioning myself now. Like, am I trying to write this way because I feel like there's some kind of status to it? And I think that I've come to the position, or maybe I'm trying to convince myself of this, because I'm going to be writing an entire essay for like part of my PhD comprehensive exams about this. So, you know, I'm really putting in a lot of effort to convince myself of this, that the reason that I like it is just because I really enjoy seeing the seams of storytelling and seeing writers sort of play with the seams and allow those seams to show, which experimental fiction often does, right? Like, it often is purposefully playing with some kind of, structure that is very clearly structured that way, or it's trying to mess up a structure, or it's trying to make you feel, frustrated with like the sort of mysteriousness of it, or it's trying to get you to engage with the journey rather than the plot. It's asking you to engage with the language rather than a plot or a character. And there's just sort of a lot of ways into it that aren't sort of, I'm just reading for the story. And I love reading for the story. I absolutely do. But I also really enjoy sort of thinking about the ways that stories are put together and why they're put together these ways. And so I think that also what I love about experimental fiction and about sort of fiction that plays with these things is that I find that it sort of is queering a kind of particular mode that is very, you know, like, here's a plot that goes from A to B to C to D. It's sort of saying, no, let's go in circles. Let's take a detour up a mountain. Let's just jump around in A and just like jump on A a lot without ever going to anywhere else. Let's just pogo stick this story. And it's just doing like other things that are refusing to sort of take a normative, whatever that might mean, kind of route to tell a story or evoke a feeling or something. So that's, I think, why I really enjoy it. And so I think I'm allowing myself to try to play with this weirdness again in a way that I sort of tried to refrain from when I wrote All My Mother's Lovers.
It sounds like you are excited about the notion of the reader being a participant, or even like more than that, meeting you more than halfway, like sort of.
I love the way you put that. I never thought about that before, but now I'm going to think about that a lot.
Yeah, because they get to play in their own way, and they get to take everything that they have to try to figure out, you know, the game or the structure, what they're supposed to be doing. And so it makes it alive in a different way for different readers, right? Like,
Yeah. And I know that not all readers like that, right? Like, and that's perfectly okay.
They want answers and satisfaction and all that. Yes, totally. Mm-hmm. But lots of readers don't.
Right. And I think, yeah. Oh, go ahead, Alex.
Oh, I was just going to say, what I loved about that answer, Alana, is from a teaching perspective, as you were saying, bringing that approach of boundaries or prompts or limitations into the classroom, it's really an inclusive act. And I remember being so resistant to prompts or anything like that as like a young writer, thinking that it was a less honest approach and thinking that I had to, you know, come up with something whole cloth and really, really work for it and, be some kind of genius idea that I came with up with late at night or something. And I was so resistant to, you know, okay, make sure the first sentence has the word red in it. Let's get a blimp in the third sentence and just see what happens, guys. And then, the result of those prompts or boundaries, like you were saying, it can be so incredibly eye-opening as a writer, realizing the limitations you were putting on yourself by thinking you didn't have limitations and working within a narrow vein, that sometimes a wide open field is the most narrow because you have nowhere to step. You don't know what you're doing. And I love that approach. I think that, as you were saying, it is however you choose to understand it as being a step away from the normative, it's so powerful.
And I also do think that, like, you know, there in some ways are only so many stories, right? And we're all always cribbing from other stories. We're all always taking inspiration from other stories. We're all, you know, I mean, like, none of us are fully inventing anything, and that's fine. Sure. And I think it's actually kind of magical to be like, okay, I know I'm not inventing anything, but let me just play around and see what happens. And it might surprise me, because I'm also used to thinking that, like, I can only tell a story in this particular way. And maybe I'll show myself that I can tell it in a different way, or that I can tell a totally different story that I never thought I could or would tell.
Absolutely. Yeah, I keep thinking about how Matt Salas is trying to talk about how you have to, like, these traditional narrative structures that we've been all been taught, you know, like, and, you know, thankfully, I think a lot of us have also dipped our toe into the experimental, and, but you have to take into account that, like, that's traditional to a single culture, right? Like, you have to think about, like, how other cultures and other people with different backgrounds are going to approach narrative. And, you know, like, if you can break out of that in any way, that it just, you know, it's like you're saying, Alex, like, it becomes more inclusive, becomes almost like, come with me, you know?
Yeah. Right.
Let's figure this out together.
Yeah. And I mean, and it is also doing something different, right? Like, what we're calling the sort of quote unquote traditional story, like, there's a place for that. And I think many, many, many people, including myself, love reading for the way that those stories are being told. So it's sort of like, it's not an instead of, it's just in addition to.
Well, yeah, if you're going to experiment, you have to know what you're experimenting with, right?
right, exactly. You have to know the rules before you can break them, which, yeah. I mean, is also, I think, not necessarily true, probably,
right,
because,
right.
But it's an approach that I think many people do end up taking, because we're so often taught the rules first.
And that's what gets published a lot.
Yes.
You know, like, that's, I mean, Alex and I talk about this a lot. Like, we love books that establish their own rules as you're reading them, and you have to learn those rules.
Yes.
And that's just exciting. That's just so exciting. You know, it becomes so immersive and playful and wild.
Yes, absolutely. And satisfying in such a, in a totally different way than, like, a plot satisfaction would be, but so satisfying to sort of figure out. I mean, this is why I also like puzzle-y TV shows. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I loved Westworld. I mean, until the latest season, which was like, eh. But I really love a lot of sort of TV shows that play with storytelling structures and time and, you know, expectations, because there is something really satisfying about trying to figure out that puzzle of, like, how are you telling the story and why are you telling it this way?
Yeah. It's, I think about that a lot because there are so many avenues in publishing, but there is also the main avenue, right? Like, and so I guess you just have to, and it's, you know, it's like what you're saying. It's like, it might change from every project, you know, like, and it's just cool that you're, you know, like, you're open to that and you're following it, you know?
It's terrifying, I won't lie, but, like, I have a crisis of confidence every other day where I'm like, this is too weird. Why am I using this voice? Why am I trying to do this? But then, you know, the next day comes and I decide to try continuing to do it and see what happens. So,
and then you're just going to see what happens and then
exactly.
See what happens and then see what happens.
Which I feel like that is a lot of what writing is ultimately,
It is. One day there's Paula Abdul and you just have to go with it.
Exactly. On a stage, on a cruise.
On that note, I would just want to thank you so much for coming on and thank you for reading to us. I feel like excited anew to play with my writing after talking about all
good.
This.
Oh, good. And thank you both so much. It's such an honor to be on this show. It is so cool. And I'm so glad you started it.
Oh, I was going to say, I'm so sorry that we stole your idea because your podcast is this.
It's not really. No. And it's also, I need to take it off of my website because I retired it. I ran it for 5.5 years and then it was finally
That's
time.
A good run.
Yeah, I think so.
Oh my God, that's amazing. I know, it was like, oh, yeah. Okay, so they read their fiction and then they have an interview. Oh my God, Alex and I stole this. Oh my God.
I didn't invent it, let's be real. I mean, I took it from the New Yorker radio hour, basically, and was like, but what if they just read their own?
Yeah.
And it's you know, and we put music in it. That was my big invention, was like getting my partner to write a bunch of music every single week.
Oh my God. Well, we apologize, but also we're glad that you came on.
Yes, and I'm glad that you're doing this.
Thank you. Thank you. And we will see you. Everyone go buy All My Mother's Lovers. It's out in paperback. So it's so affordable.
And it is the best version of, you know, it's the best format, as we all know, of paper books. It's the best format.
Carry it anywhere.
Exactly. You know? Bend it.
Yes. Yes.
You know, put it upside down.
Wear it.
Not like face pages open.
Yes.
Indestructible.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yes.
That was great.
That was really fun.
So I'm serious, like talking about experimenting and experimental fiction and constraints and prompts. I love all that shit.
Yeah.
Unabashedly.
Yeah. Did you always?
I never knew about it until I went to grad school. And I took I took a class with Matthew Gulish on constraints. And it was so fun. And I never looked back.
They work. I took a class with John Keane. It was a similar thing. And the first thing I ever got published was a result of that. And I remember it like exploded my brain that I didn't have to know where I was going. Or, I mean, it sounds so stupid for so many of our listeners, I'm sure, because you're like, yeah, no shit, dumbass. But it really was like shocking to me.
That is such a common thing, because you read the stories and the books that you love, and it feels like they knew from the beginning, you know, like it feels like this was set in stone. They're just brilliant and it comes naturally. And maybe that does happen every once in a while, but it's like, you know, I spent way too much time convincing myself that that's how it was. And that I just was working too hard and that I'd never be all that good, you know? And then, and then hopefully you get liberated from that and you just decide to do the thing that you do. Right. And yeah, definitely constraints helped with that. So what
you got a tattoo today?
I did. I got a tattoo. I got lots of tattoos today. But yes.
How many tattoos would you say that you got today?
20. But they're also tiny.
20?
Maybe more.
Tiny 20.
Tiny 20. Tiny 20. Yeah, it was 20. It was a great. I was very nervous because I had to go. She's a tattoo artist and she's a lead singer in a band I really love called Dead. And I was really nervous because I had to go to her house, her apartment, and be in her apartment, just me and her. And I was like, I'm going to say so many dumb things. Like, my stomach's going to make a weird noise. I'm going to freak her out because I love her band. But it was so great. She was so wonderful. And we had a great conversation about like the creative life and how she balances what she calls her gifts. So her tattooing and her music. And I don't know, I just felt like so happy to have had that experience and to let her just kind of like take control of what we were going to do on my arm. And I don't know, it was great.
It's awesome.
You can teach an old dog new tricks and you can tattoo an old 41-year-old lady.
Sure.
Sure.
I mean, we got living proof.
And Emily Adrian also got a tattoo today. Holler,
it's
Emily.
It's tattoo day. Holler, Emily.
We'll be talking to her soon.
Yes.
Yours? Not soon enough though. That's like in September.
Yeah, she can come on twice. It's cool.
Sure, sure, sure. And I'm reading. Oh my God, I'm reading the best book.
Really?
It's called The Comfort of Monsters, and it is. I'm doing an event with her by Willa C. Richards.
I don't know this book.
Oh my God, it's so good. I'm doing an event with her on Thursday, July 29th through. Exile in Bookville. And if you guys are interested, you can look at my Instagram. I've got the link there and I'll try to post about it on my other social media pages.
Is that book out yet?
It is out and it is so good. It's about a woman whose sister goes missing in the summer that they caught Jeffrey Dahmer in Milwaukee.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. And you know, he killed boys and men. So it's more about like her disappearance kind of going under the radar because the city was so overcome with Jeffrey Dahmer. And then also about like how Jeffrey Dahmer has turned into this like strangely heroic cult figure, you know, like people are obsessed with him and they want to know all about him. And
God damn.
When really it should be about the victims anyway, but it's a novel. And it's also from the point of view of a very unreliable narrator whose memory is extremely flawed. And so I don't know. It's very, and
I'm sold.
Oh yeah. You got to read it. I'm reading it directly after reading What Happened to Paula, which is nonfiction about the murder of a woman in 1970 and how that kind of was brushed away. And so it's like, they're speaking to each other. These books were like, it's weird that I read them back to back because they have so many, like there was like the woman's sister was trying to find her in the real book, in the nonfiction book, and same in this book. Anyway, I'm really enjoying it. So I look forward to talking to her about that. It's July 29th.
Cool.
And Alex is going to start manuscript consultations.
Sure, sure. Oh my God, I'm reading a fucking crazy book. Have you ever heard of the book Letters to Wendy?
Letters to Wendy. Who wrote it?
Joe Wenderoth.
No, I'm looking it up.
Oh my God. My...
Why is it crazy?
Well, it is. So the whole I've only read like 15 pages of this, and I already know that I'm gonna love it. It's insane.
Oh my God! I just read the synopsis. Go ahead.
Yeah. So the whole conceit is that he's writing, the narrator is writing letters to the restaurant, letters to the actual fictional Wendy of the Wendy's hamburger chain on the like comment cards that they used to have at Wendy's. And it's the action of the book, if you could describe it, that is takes place in 1996 and it was published in 2000. So they actually did have comment cards back then, but
it takes place in 96 and it was published in 2000.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Did he write anything after that?
Yeah, apparently this is like a well-known person. And this is the first time I've ever heard of him. But yeah, I mean, I think most of the other stuff is poetry.
Yes.
And this is like prose poemy. I'm not sure what it's actually, I don't know if you know, when they like online, if it's sold under fiction or prose poetry or whatever, but it's totally vulgar and insane. And I love it.
Yeah, it says he's an American writer, performer, teacher, and filmmaker, and he's published 6 books, 4 books of poetry, an epistolary novel, and a book of essays. And he curates The Seizure State, which appears in the Brooklyn-based magazine Gigantic. So he's on fire.
He's on fire.
Okay, Joe Wenderoth.
Okay.
That book sounds so good.
Yeah, it's very up your alley. I mean, it's completely fucked, but it's really good.
Yes. Okay. I see a picture of him sitting next to Ronald McDonald. I'm in.
Way in.
I'm so in. Awesome.
I think that's all I got. You got anything? Anything else good happen?
I saw Space Jam, A New Legacy yesterday.
Was it good?
You know what? I am the target audience for that kind of content because I was like giggling and loving it. So, yeah, I loved it. It was great.
Can you share with our audience the line that your middle child delivered 20 minutes into the movie?
Yeah. Okay. Well, there was like a bunch of previews to start. And so he'd be like, is this Space Jam? And I'd be like, no, this is a preview. So then Space Jam started and I was like, look, it's the new Space Jam movie. And he's seen the first one. So I was like, yeah, look, there's LeBron as a boy, you know, he's talking to his mom. So like I had told him this was Space Jam. So 20 minutes goes by and he has to lean over my other kid to say this, mom, when does Space Jam start?
I love that.
His brother was like, this is Space Jam, you idiot. Yeah, but it was great. I recommend it.
I'm going to see it.
Yeah. There was like moments specifically for like our generation who love nostalgia throwbacks to like things we watched when we were kids. And I know you're younger than I am. I know, but like there's a big audience watching the big game at the end, and it's filled with Warner Brothers characters. So like there's Gremlins there, there's the Jetsons, there's Iron Giant. There's just like everywhere you look, it's like it was there, Pennywise.
Oh, Jesus.
Watching the game. So it was, yeah.
I love how you said, I know you're younger than me, as if I was going to stop you from talking and like claim that we were different generations. Like that was
never
important to me.
Assume that we're the same generation.
Oh my God.
Anyway, that's it. Thanks for playing.
That's it. Okay. I'll play again next week. Sure.
Okay. Sounds great. Bye.
Okay. Bye.
I'm a Writer But is recorded by Alex Higley and me, Lindsay Hunter, in our respective basements. Editing by Lindsay Hunter. Music by Max Loop. Yay!